Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to our monthly Awakening Together satsang, and I'm here tonight with Kirtana. And as you all know, Kirtana is going to be one of the retreat leaders at our Awakening Together satsang coming up September 12 to 14 in Santa Barbara. And I know that we're all familiar with her music. I had actually not heard of her. I don't even remember how I heard of her, but I had not heard of her, and we were looking for a musician for the retreat, and, you know, just every musician that was suggested just didn't feel right, and then somehow, I don't remember how, I came across Kirtana, and instantly I went, ah, that's the one. And so I wrote to her and asked her if she'd join us for the retreat, and she said yes, and I was so excited. And so I've spent the last year really getting to know her music well. And in fact, now if you check out my playlist on my website, you'll notice even though I have a large variety of songs, the one artist that I have the most songs from is now Kirtana. So I'm very familiar with her now. And of course, we've played her music a lot in the room. And the other day we were sending around a video that I know several of you saw of Eckhart Tolle listening to one of Kirtana's songs. And it's such a lovely, lovely video because he starts crying. And oh. Have you seen it, Kirtana?
I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just so touching because you can tell that you're singing his heart. You know, that's what you're doing. You are singing his heart, and it's so lovely. So we all know you now. A year ago, I may not have, but I do now, and I'm very, very grateful to have come across your music. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here with you.
You know, I don't know much about you other than your music. Of course, your music is your heart, so in that way, I know you perfectly. But mm-hmm. I don't know much about you other than your music. I did read that you've been playing music, I believe, and writing music since you were around 11. And also, at a very young age, you began reading metaphysical teachings. Do you want to start there, speak a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I probably started writing poetry when I was 9 or 10. So that was a strong inspiration, probably more for cathartic reasons than anything else. I think some people have a strong need to express creatively. And I'm one of them, and that really helped me balance my emotions to do that. And then a year later, I got my first guitar, so I was 11 years old, and began writing songs right away, actually, maybe within a few months. But I pretty much kept that to myself, just played in my room. And, you know, I felt at that age really like a stranger in a strange land on this planet. And it wasn't that I had, a particularly challenging childhood. You know, I think I grew up with a fairly ordinary family in the sense of, you know, a little dysfunctional. Some inner turmoil, I would say. But I just had this strong ache from a young age, kind of longing, you know, and I felt like nothing seemed familiar to me here. I had some almost cellular memory of a different way of being or a time when I felt more connected to the oneness of creation, and I had a longing for that. So when I, around the age of 14 or 15, I discovered a few different books on my mother's bookshelf of a metaphysical nature, you know, Edgar Cayce books and Autobiography of a Yogi, Alan Watts. And it was so amazing for me to hear a language that really resonated with my little being, of something deep and the superficial event I was observing, and on a planet that was seemingly boring all the time. And, you know, so I thought about it since then. It's like, how discover these books all at once? And I think it was because my parents had just separated, and my mom had these books, but she was hiding my father. So when they split up, they came you know, into full view on her bookshelf. I went, wow. And it was like a spiritual gold mine for me to discover those books.
And so you were very young when you started. So, you know, just kind of between then and now, you know, what are like the key points, the key highlights of your spiritual path?
Well, they're like different chapters. Like, when I was 17, I started TM. So that was a huge, powerful, transformative chapter of my life. Many years of meditating regularly twice a day. And I was actually a pretty young teacher of TM too. I got trained in that just before I turned 22. So I taught TM for a while and graduated from the TM college actually with a lit major in my mid-20s. So that was a big, long chapter. And it was beautiful because the meditation was like a tuning fork for my nervous system. And I had very profound experiences of the more, you know, our more absolute nature. And I was following those experiences. But after a while, it seemed that enlightenment wasn't, I was on a track toward enlightenment by starting meditation and being regular. And then it was twice a day, regular meditation wasn't enough. You needed more advanced technique and Ayurvedic things. And then you needed, you know, and it seemed to me like the goalpost kept moving forward in it. And like, maybe there was no end to it, you know? And I could see now that I had a very achievement-oriented mind. I thought, you know, okay, just tell me what to do. Enlightened, and I'll put it on my list. But the list kept growing, you know. So I got a little, I don't know if disillusion is the right word, but there were also, you know, I have a kind of rebellious nature relative to organizations, too. And rules, and so it was challenging for me to be representing that organization with all their particular rules, and myself, one element of it. And then I just kept questioning what, you know, I had experienced firsthand the obvious benefit of doing a deep meditation practice, the calming effect and the well-being. In the experience of higher states of consciousness, but I just had a lot of questions about continuing on in that way, and it seemed I was discouraged with it all, and I needed to take a break. And there were kind of hierarchies within the organization that concerned me too, you know, because sometimes you can't escape that, even if it's a spiritual organization. The same things that would happen, like at a large corporation, the competitiveness and the jealousy between people that have this technique or that, you know, it was just all too much. So I took a break from it, got more involved. So that was the TM phase of my life, and then I entered the more New Age phase of my life, where enlightenment as a goal took a backseat, and I just decided to catch up on the things I'd missed by doing so many spiritual pursuits when I was young. Be a little bit more embodied in the world, and that I got more involved in the kind of new thought, the kind of thinking that new thought churches have about just manifesting the reality I want, you know, choosing the reality I want, and then thinking that if I didn't have a perfect relationship or health or perfect health, there must be something wrong with me, looking at myself, you know. It just was a shift of focus and exploration in a different way. And I got a little involved temporarily with another spiritual spiritual teacher, a guru. And that was really kind of the end of the whole guru disciple thing for me. It was just too much fanfare and hullabaloo, and it seemed like too much giving of power away or something. I didn't know what it was. I just felt really disillusioned. So I'd given up on that, and I was just going to live, you know, a good life.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know. And then I met Dangaji, and I wasn't searching for a teacher at the time, but a friend of mine, I was having dinner with a friend, and after dinner she said, would you be sitting watching some tape of the teacher Gangaji? And I'd heard her name before and I was curious, so I said, what the heck? No. And, you know, within 60 seconds of seeing her on the video, I was mesmerized in a way that I can't explain, because she was speaking in a language that I hadn't quite heard before, and felt my heart open, and I knew something profound was happening, and so I decided to pay attention to it. I feel like I'm talking too much. So.
You're not talking too much. First of all, because you're here, because we want to listen to you.
They
just listen to me for an hour. They're tired of my voice.
No, I know, but I just could be.
No,
that can guide me with your questions.
Well, and you know, you went into the beginning of your relationship with Gangaji, and I would like to hear more about that. I'd like you to go ahead and go deeper in that direction and tell us more about that.
You know, I had some sense, even with the previous teacher that I had, that even though I had become disillusioned with the spirit, quest for enlightenment, I had some sense that there was a way in which I might have sabotaged my own spiritual growth, that I couldn't really blame it all on my past teachers or the fact that enlightenment doesn't exist. There was a kind of sense of my own cynicism around it and my own role in it, but I couldn't really articulate that. So I decided to be, you know, something's happening. I'm feeling like profound love. I don't know this person. I'm feeling profound love. And there's a language that's resonating with me. And even, you know, early on in that videotape, she was reading letters from students in the audience or that had mailed them in. And the quality in the letters, even in the questions and the reports of the people that were with her, reflected a beautiful kind of spiritual intelligence that I hadn't quite seen in that way before. And I just knew I had to spend more time with her. And very shortly after that, she actually decided to move to Marin County after living in Colorado. So she came out. I was living in Big Sur at the time, and it was about a 3-hour drive, but I started to go once a week for a really long time, and to sit with her. And I really could write a book about even one 20-minute exchange with her, you know, that I had. But I don't know. I could write a book or I could say nothing, because, you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, trying to be objective about myself, I can be pretty articulate accidentally when I'm writing music, you know. And then I can be completely speechless when I'm trying to describe what happened. But I came with all the spiritual concepts I'd developed over, you know, 15 years or whatever it was of meditating, and all the wealth of beautiful Vedic knowledge that I had amassed. And I had a lot of concepts to break through that were maybe more detrimental than people would realize in many ways, even though there was a profound beauty to a lot of it. sometimes a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, you know, or sometimes you can know too much. I mean, I think there's a value in innocence of experience and also in this culture, we really do worship the mind. So I wasn't even aware that my mind was actively amassing this knowledge for its own sense of security and curiosity, you know? So I can describe it in different ways, but one way I can describe the change that took place as I had like a, well, I went to several meetings with her and something profound, like I said, was happening. It was like the cells in my body were rearranging themselves. I wasn't doing anything. I just knew at a really deep level something profound was happening, and fortunately I knew enough to just show up, you know, and not get in the way of it. And then I had one really profound interaction that I call my Zen stick experience with her, where I felt like just pummeled me, you know, and I can't explain how that was, but it was as if she kicked my mind like a football, you know, and I was so stunned. It was almost traumatic on an emotional body level too, to be honest. You know, it wasn't like, it wasn't comfortable in any sense of the word. And yet it was so profound that I knew to just keep showing up, even though it didn't feel comfortable, even though at another time my ego would have bolted, you know. So I just kept showing up, and in that willingness to not know what was going on, and I just felt this level of surrender and awe. At the mystery of what was taking place. And I realized at a certain point that I had so much time trying to change, to either get enlightenment or change what is, because of my new age concepts, that I hadn't really stopped to be fully present in any moment, because there was always some improvement that could have been made, you know, to my life. Either because I didn't have enlightenment yet, or because I needed a better job or a better, you know, my attention was always going into the future, and something just happened where I just had to, it took a long time for my mind to come back. Actually, she kicked it so far. And my heart was so enlivened. And I realized in that moment that I saw that I was being held, and that all of us are always being held in this beautiful, it was the only word I could use for it, but it was like this the being that connects us all, that also holds us all. And I'd never really seen that before. I thought, you know, that the metaphor that came to mind to me at the time was I'd been like a small child having a tantrum, you know, not happy with what is, wanting to be enlightened, wanting things to be different, not really just stopping and being fully in this experience of life and seeing that I'm held just like the child is with the mother that just watches the tantrum. And so much, there was so much in that willingness to not know and to be fully present and to put the concerns and desires of my mind aside and just be here.
You mentioned about some of the concepts, you know, that you had in your mind that you'd learned from your previous spiritual path. And you said something about, you know, some of those concepts really not being at all helpful. You know, made me think of they were actually an obstacle rather than truly, you know, escalating you into realization. Do you remember any of the obstacles at all that were kind of in your way that you're grateful they dropped away? Just in case there's anybody listening who's still holding on to them, it might be nice to hear that.
Well, I'll preface this by saying, you know, that every course I took, every technique I learned, everything I did to refine my consciousness or improve my life or quality of experience through TM or anything else, I could have chosen to see that simply as a refinement. But instead, I saw them all at items on a checklist toward my goal of enlightenment. So I'm taking responsibility for the way I view that. You know, every time Maharishi offered a new technique, I didn't have to think of it as necessary for enlightenment, but that's how my mind interpreted that. He could have been offering it purely as a way to refine our consciousness, but in that spiritual milieu, you know, of techniques and achievements, that's the way my mind structured it.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes
sense. So it wasn't like it was an obstacle, but the way my mind held it was an obstacle because I don't actually know of anybody that ever really awakened just from doing a series of, like, techniques or, you know, living in a Stapacha Vate house or wearing, you know what I mean? It's like those things maybe they put you in a better position to receive fully, but they don't. Cause. It's not like a cause and effect thing.
Yeah, I have, there's a book that I'm going to say I wrote it, but I didn't write it. It was, the book itself was my teacher, so I wrote it in that way, like probably like you write some of your music, mm-hmm. I would imagine. And in that book, it says that the spiritual path is like a double-edged sword, because it can lead to life or it can lead to death, you know, and, you know, so we can become, you know, very involved in, like you're talking about, the achieving. We can be very proud of our spiritual mm-hmm. accomplishments. And, you know, as you know, the ego just gets bigger and bigger
right.
through that. Or, depending on how you look at it, depending on how you're using it, it can be in the opposite direction where there's a disappearing, a fading that is happening. So, you know, that's kind of what you're reminding me of as you're saying it was really the way that your mind was interpreting what was
right.
happening. Yeah.
Yeah, if I just viewed it as not an end in itself, but just something, you know, like exercises, like physical exercises or eating good food is. It's a way to, in that case, you know, good exercise and food is a way to maintain your body. It's not a requirement of enlightenment. It's something you do to take care of your form if you're interested in taking care of your form, right? And there are other things that we do to refine our personalities. There are various therapies that we can be involved in it. But that if you think of any one of those things as an end in itself toward a goal of enlightenment, then you'll be constantly disappointed because
right.
the self reveals itself to itself and you can be present, desire it, and pay attention. But beyond that, I'm not saying techniques don't have any value, but they're not I just had an orientation where it was like, that's the way the mind works. It's like, tell me what to do, I'll do it, and then I want to see the result of that. And it doesn't work like that. So that was my own obstacle created from that. Plus, another one conceptually was, I feel like I had this sense of higher states of consciousness. I'd had experiences of different states that, being trained as a teacher, I could describe in great detail, you know, because I knew the signposts of every different progressive state. And in my mind, I viewed them as part of this linear journey, and that every state of consciousness, as you evolved along this linear path, you would be like a whole new person, but you'd still be the same person, but it would be like a glorified aspect of yourself, and life would be easier and sweeter and more profound and light-filled, and it would just get progressively deeper. I mean, I just had these concepts of what it meant, because I had tastes of different states of consciousness, so I also, what I was seeking was a sustained higher state of consciousness. And that's pretty much everybody in the TM organization.
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting point to bring up, that what you were seeking was a sustained higher state of consciousness. So, you know, what would you say enlightenment is? If it's not a sustained higher state of consciousness, if somebody, you say, well, then what is it? What would be
your answer? I know. I had the hardest time. My mind had the hardest time with that. And, you know, I would say it's really hard to articulate, but it's a realization of who we are as awareness, and in that awareness, states of consciousness come and go.
Very good.
But I know that sounds abstract to people. It really took a while for my mind to sink into not needing to have a sustained state of consciousness. I mean, look at what happens to us in waking and sleeping, and we're very comfortable moving between waking and sleeping and dreaming states of consciousness. We don't think twice about it. We don't think, oh my God, I'm going into that state again. You
know? Yeah.
So, I mean, I've expanded my concepts, and I feel very relaxed around the whole states of consciousness thing, finally. And I feel movements coming and going within that. And I'm aware of the continuity underlying those changes. And that's what I call enlightenment or awakening. Not that there aren't other kinds and definitions. I mean, there are, I have no doubt, beings that are living in a sustained higher state of consciousness. I don't think there are too many, but there are definitely beings living in a sustained higher state of consciousness. Brahman consciousness. But if you're attached to that and nothing in your present moment is going to bring happiness or joy or peace other than that experience, you're missing what's here.
Yeah, what you just said is so important that I kind of want to pause and like say it again, you know, that if you're after some higher state of consciousness that's not here now, and you think that you have to have that to be satisfied,
right,
then in this current moment, you don't have the opportunity to be happy with what is right now.
Yeah, right.
It just has you always seeking, always grasping.
Right.
Yeah, that's so important. And, you know, it took me a long, long time to get that, to realize that. You know, I always had the goal out there.
Right. And that's exactly what I was saying, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know exactly when it shifted into, you know, be here now. I didn't have a dramatic event. I can't point to a day. It was more of a gradual relaxing in. But at some point, that idea of a goal died. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's the same. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. I mean, you could spend your whole life seeking it, and it's a beautiful goal. Because what really the goal is to be in a state of peace, live life fully from the most expanded perspective possible. And you can still do that without the mind being in a sustained state of higher consciousness all the time.
Yeah. You know, as I mentioned, there, you know, the people are able to actually write in the room, and you know, they're not asking any questions at this point. And by the way, I just want to let you all know that you can ask questions. It's more helpful if you put your hand up, because then I will see you for sure. So they're not asking any questions at this point, but all of their comments are resonating with you, is what I would say. They're just, you know, lots of people here writing comment after comment after comment that's resonating. And in fact, like a moment ago, you said something about your description being abstract. And one person in the room, Jacqueline, wrote, "Nope, not abstract, perfect." So, good. And they're saying, "Beautiful discussion, and thank you for sharing." And they understand the idea of striving through technique and why that is not helpful. So, I just thought I'd let you know they are listening and they are appreciating and understanding.
Thanks.
Now, I don't know Gangaji well. I do know who she is. You know, and in fact, I even see a somewhat of a resemblance between you and her.
Yeah.
Probably more the hair than anything else.
Yeah.
Do other people tell you that?
Yes, they do.
So I do know who she is, and I do know that Papaji was her teacher.
Right.
And I think I even heard the story about how she actually became sick, physically ill or something, and that had some relationship to her awakening or her realization. Do you know her story very well?
I don't know that aspect of it. I know bits here and there of her story. I don't really want to make a mistake by something that I'm remembering, but I do know her husband Eli is the one that discovered Papaji by accident. He was en route to see a different teacher, and either the plane or the train got waylaid in Lucknow, and he had some memory of hearing about some great being that lived there, and so he tracked him down, and he was so blown away that he wrote Gangaji immediately, or called and said, "You have to get here." And she didn't have any desire at first to go, because she actually had a teacher in, I think they were living in the Bay Area at the time, that she was happy with. And he just worked on her. He said, "No, this is the real deal." And so she got on a plane and went out there. And she had a pretty immediate awakening with him. That's my assessment of her story. But I don't know. She had some health challenges later from being in India, but I don't know that they were part of her.
Yeah, I'll have to look up the story later and check my memory. My memory's not the best either, so yeah. Well, for, you know, there may be people in the room. I think a lot of people in the room do know Gangaji. In fact, even right now, Sharon has written, "Love her." And I saw earlier when we mentioned her name, people were saying how much they loved her. But in case there's someone in the room that just has no idea who Gangaji is, which is possible, because,
sure,
you know, awakening together, we embrace all spiritualities that point to truth, and, you know, some of these people just may have no idea. So could you talk a little bit about her teaching, or how would you describe Gangaji to someone who doesn't know who she is?
You know, I thought from her name when I first, I'd heard about her for a couple of years before I watched the video. I just assumed she was Indian. So part of my surprise when I watched the video with my friend was just discovering that she was an American woman. Just the fact that she's a woman and that she's American set her apart back then, because that was like 16, 17 years ago, you know. Now there's been such an explosion of teachers of awakening But at the time, it seemed like they were mostly teachers coming from India. And so to meet somebody that has the Western upbringing and knows the way the Western mind works is a beautiful thing, too. Because she could deal with my mind in a way that, like the previous Indian teacher couldn't, you know. Because I didn't even know what my mind was doing with concepts of enlightenment. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But somebody who has a Western mind and is really familiar with the Western mind works. And so, and she's extremely articulate. She doesn't advocate any particular techniques. That was just the contrast between everything I'd done before and the fact that there's no technique and we're just sitting and nothing has to be done. We're just paying attention and sharing stories and asking questions. And so I can't even describe what she does except, I mean, like Papaji, when he sent her out into the world, she said, I don't know anything. I can't do this. And he said, great. just share your experience. So that's what she does. She shares her experience and it has a profound effect on people. Okay. I don't know how to compare her to other teachers, but you know, she's a non-dual teacher, although she wouldn't use that word to describe herself, I don't think.
So what I'm hearing, and you may correct me if I'm wrong, because of course I'm interpreting what I'm hearing from you, but what I'm hearing is that when you were in her presence, probably because of her own consistent awareness, you experienced grace. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
So...
But if you asked her, are you giving a transmission?
Right.
She would say, no, I'm not. I'm just talking.
Yeah, I understand. She's just being in that presence. And so then that presence somehow is, I'm stumbling over words now too, but it's big. That presence is big in her presence.
Right.
And so as a result, you know, it's, you know, you're able to pick up on it if you're ready. Now, what about people who aren't ready? Could they, you know, do they show up as well and do they see nothing there?
I mean, I would imagine that there are people that, that see nothing. But, you know, the way she describes it is her role is, which I think is beautiful and I think is true. She's not teaching anybody anything, but she's confirming something. So people that have a certain level of experience are drawn to her. And if people, you know, maybe somebody gets dragged there to check her out and they don't resonate and they leave. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. But for the most part, people that are drawn to her have already had what she calls the essential experience. And, you know, for myself, to go back to the meditating days, I would say that, I mean, I was having profound experiences of pure awareness. But I was the meditator. I was identified with the meditator having the experience of unbounded awareness. And what she did for me was, and I don't know how, but she got, through the grace of sitting with her, I could see what I had read and heard 1,000 times before, that unbounded awareness is not just something I'm having the experience of, it's who I am. So my identity shifted from being a meditator, having the experience, to a deeper knowing that is who Kirtana's form is resting in.
Yes.
And Kirtana's mind and emotional body, you know. So
yes, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand.
And she would say, you know, she also would kind of joke about how you can catch this, you know, you can catch this. And so sometimes there'd be somebody in the audience who would be having like a really profound, deep, heart-opening, revelatory experience of this. and they'd be so on fire, and somebody else would be like, I don't get it. And she'd say, go sit next to that person. Like, literally, go sit next to that person, because you can catch it.
Well, you know, I was reading recently, I was reading Adyashanti's book, Resurrecting Jesus, and he talks in that book about, you know, the word transmission. He talks about the experience of transmission, and he doesn't really claim that it's a transmission either. He's just using the word because people do. And he said, if you don't understand it, try this. Imagine walking into a room where there's somebody in there that's like just in this really rotten, depressed mood. And said, you know, when you walk into that room, if that's the only person in the room, you feel that. You feel right. that heaviness. And he said, right. transmission is the same thing, but the other way. If right. there's someone that's really aware of our truth, aware of awareness, you know, in the grace, and you get near that one, you feel that as well. And that makes perfect sense for people who think that transmission is some kind of a magic.
Right.
You know, we've all walked into a room where the air was so thick from someone's negativity that it felt like you could cut it. And so,
right.
And so this is the other side. This is, you know.
That's a great way to describe it.
Yeah.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah, I thought you did a great job with that as well. Now tell me, you know, there's a difference between, and I know you know this, there's a difference between temporary experiences and awareness of consistency or constancy. So you talked about when you were with Gangaji and she kicked your mind like a football and it was gone for a very, very long time. But since you said it was gone for a very, very long time, that means that in some way it also came back, correct?
Yeah, it came back, but it didn't come back in the way you might think of it coming back. I mean, it came back. When she kicked it and it was gone, it was like I was somewhat dysfunctional in many ways for a while. Because, you know, you need your mind to do things well.
Oh, hold on one second. I think somebody just knocked the mic out of my hand. Let me turn it back on. Okay, we're back in the room. Please continue, Kirtana.
What I was saying is that you need your mind to do basic living operations. You need a little bit of mind anyway. Right?
Yes.
So I think what happened to my mind was just when it started to come back, it came back, you know, in a way that was actually helpful to me. Because I don't want to be disparaging about the mind, you know. I wouldn't be able to write any songs if I didn't have a mind.
You wouldn't know words.
Right? Yeah. I mean, everybody's down on the mind, including myself sometimes, but in the past I've been, you know, and I realize I got to be careful what I say about the mind. I've made jokes about, you know, not needing the mind before in the middle of a concert, and then 2 minutes later I start to sing a song and can't remember the words, and I'm like, okay, I'm sorry, mind.
I didn't mean to put you down. Please come back.
Yeah. When my mind came back, I would say with a newfound humility. Not that it isn't, you know, not that it's always that way, but it was, it like came back knowing its place and subservient to a higher force, yeah.
Yeah, so the mind became the tool.
Right.
That's used.
Right.
Yeah. And that's not much different than a hand being a tool that's used. You know, when I reach out to grasp this glass of water, I'm using the hand. But I don't think,
right.
but I don't think I am the hand. You know,
right.
I don't identify with the hand the way we identify with the mind.
Right, exactly.
So, tell me, since this experience, again, of, as you described it, having your mind kicked like a football, have you had any periods that you would consider purification or settling into experience, letting go of obstacles that were still there, anything like that?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I had a couple of years of some, like hard emotional entanglements that At first, when they started happening, I realized they felt very gripping to me in a way that was almost embarrassing to me. And then I realized if I'm embarrassed, I must have an ego with it, you know?
Yeah.
But it was like, I can't believe that I'm feeling this, you know, this, that this feels so painful, or I'm still so caught up in the energy of this, you know? So I would just say that I had some, they felt like, almost like karmic knots that needed to be unraveled, and there was still some, what do they call those?
Samskaras or something like
that? Yeah, I could, you know, for the first couple of years, I couldn't really even relate to that, but then I was like, oh, this must be what they meant when that they can arise, and it felt like it took me for quite a ride. And now once I came through it, I look back on it and I go, what was that? That was like nothing, you know, but
I understand.
It felt so excruciating, you know? At the time it felt so excruciating. And then it was like nothing. It's like nothing. I have no, like, I can't even relate to what was actually so hard about that. You know, it's funny.
Yeah, I understand. I had, my period was about 5 years. And, you know, I always tell people when I was going through it, you know, it just seemed like it would last forever, you know. Mm-hmm. And now that I look back and I go, wow, I can't believe that happened so fast. It's so easy. So, yeah, it's completely different. But I think it's important to talk about these things because, as you know, there are still people who, you know, who want to realize truth, want to have enlightenment, want to awaken, whatever you call, because there's a sense of escaping pain and suffering.
Right.
And it's important to know that can still arise, and that needs to arise until it's seen through or undone or whatever is happening there. And in fact, it's grace that actually pushes it up is the way that I perceive it.
Yeah.
And everybody goes through it. If you were talking to someone who's really suffering, you know, really suffering because they're struggling, that's where I think the suffering comes from. If you're resting with it, it seems easier. But if you're talking to someone who's really suffering, having been through it yourself, what would you recommend?
Well, I can just share kind of my own perspective with it. First of all, it's good to distinguish between suffering and shame, because no matter what level of consciousness or awakening we experience, there is pain on this human dimension to the physical body and the emotional body potentially, and that's fairly unavoidable, like, to my knowledge, you know. But if you're resting in the awareness, you're more removed from it, but it's still the emotional body and the physical body can have the pain. But what makes it suffering rather than pain is a story that you have with it. You know, like if you put your hand in a flame, it hurts. No matter how awake you are, you know, there's pain, right?
Yes.
But, you know, if a week later you're still in anguish because your mind is telling yourself a story about that experience, then that's suffering.
Yeah,
that's suffering, and it's unnecessary.
Yes.
You know, pain when it's experienced purely, emotional pain or physical pain, when it's experienced purely, I mean, I know there are exceptions to this. There are people that have pain in their body, you know, their whole lives. But for the average person, when they experience pain, it comes and goes, and then it's gone. Even emotional pain should be like that. But if it's still lingering, like emotional pain, if you're still thinking about it and struggling with it, then there's a story the mind is repeating that is enlivening it again and again. And that's suffering. In my own experience with that emotional entanglement period that felt so excruciating, I mean, I realized at a certain point, it took a while, but I realized at a certain point that I still had a story of victimization going in my head, because it felt like what had happened was unnecessarily cruel and unfair. And so my mind is holding on to that story that they shouldn't have done this to me, that hurt more than it should, whatever it was. It was like I still had a story. So if it's possible in those moments to see whether you're running a poor me story because of some event that happened in your life, and you're telling that again and again in your mind, if it's possible to see that and take a break from that and experience the pain in a really pure way where you're just meeting it with your full consciousness rather than telling any story about it, just as if it were just an energy form that you were meeting, then you can have a whole different relationship to it. Another thing I realized in my experience was, even though part of the conundrum for me when this was happening was it didn't make sense to my mind. Sometimes an experience happens that's painful, but I can see on some level, like, oh, I've done that before to other people, and I needed to experience what that's like. You know, there'd be like this karmic point of reference for it in my mind, which is its own, you know, mental structure, spiritual structure. If my mind had a place to put it where it made sense. Or an experience would happen and I could see immediately the value of it, even if it was painful. Right?
Yes.
And again, my mind could put it in a spiritual framework, and yeah, that was painful, but you know, this came of it. Well, this experience I couldn't do that with. It just felt, like I said, unnecessarily painful and not fair. But just even the word "not fair," it wasn't. You know, it took a while to see that's running a story. What do I know about what is supposed to happen? Who is the mind to decide what grace is? And I also realized that I'd written this, I wrote this song like 12 or 15 years before I had this difficult experience. It was a prayer for awakening, and one of the lines of the song was, "Wake me, if you need to, you can shake me." And those words came back to me one day when I was reflecting on this conundrum, and it was like, oh my God, I'm just getting what I asked for. I wanted total surrender into the present moment and not to be second-guessing the creator or whatever language you want to use, so the self and the way, the mystery of the unfoldment of consciousness. So if you don't have an opinion about how things should be, and you're willing to experience pain as it arises in a pure way without running a story constantly in your mind after the fact, then it's possible to be free of suffering. And if you feel like you're still struggling, I mean, there are people that, you know, can help point things out or be like a counselor. But if you're willing, if you really, truly want to be free, then you have to be willing to tell the truth. Am I running a story of victimization? Am I telling a story of the pain long after the pain has subsided? Am I, you just have to be, you have to kind of cultivate curiosity, I think, and be willing to be open and not have any idea of what is supposed to happen in life.
Yeah, I started playing with that by imagining my life as a movie. that's what allowed me to get out of that. It was my bridge. Because when I'm watching a movie, I don't want to know what's happening next.
Right.
Or, you know, so I started imagining my life as a movie, and then eventually I moved beyond that. But it was a tool that allowed me just to experience the experience without needing to understand or without needing to know what's happening next, or it was a very helpful tool for me.
Good. That's good, yeah. I have a line in my train song about viewing it as a mystery, viewing it from the balcony and treating it like a mystery.
Yes, that would be the same idea, exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, we haven't talked about your music yet, so maybe we should talk about your music.
Okay.
I can't even tell you off the top of my head what albums that I have music from because I download from iTunes. You know, I hear a song and I fall in love with it and I download it. I can tell you my latest acquisition is Happy Birthday, Jesus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I'm so in love with that song. I just think it's beautiful. But every one of your songs that I've downloaded, like some of the others I have are I Said That I Would Sing. Of course, Who We Really Are, Always Here. I mean, I'd have to open it up because my mind is not that good at remembering, but there's a list of songs. I guess my first question is, do you have favorite songs from among your songs, and if so, why?
You know, in a way, I don't. You know, I in a way I do, in a way I don't, I guess. And my favorite could change.
Yeah.
But they're all my children, and I have a fondness for all of them, and I let go of them after they arise. So when you're saying when you're naming those titles, I'm like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. I don't sit around and listen to them, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I understand. I don't really read the books that I've written except when I'm teaching from them. I don't sit around and read them, right. And so I understand. And, in fact, right after I asked you if you had a favorite song, the thought I heard in my mind was, you're asking her if she has a favorite child.
Exactly. Yeah, people, yeah. But, you know, if you'd ask me if I could only keep three songs or something, I might be able to pick three that I would keep. But it isn't. I don't want to offend my other songs, you know, because I love them all. So.
Well, then let me ask the question a different way. Are there songs that you notice other people using more in their own awakening process?
Well, you know, like in a workshop level way, maybe like Who You Really Are gets used possibly more than any other song. But different organizations have used different ones repeatedly. In terms of people like you or others listening on their own and sharing their favorites, there's no little pattern, because somebody, even a song that I might think is a really unlikely favorite, is, I'll find out, is somebody's favorite. So, there's some that are more like teaching kind of songs, I guess, that lend themselves more to like a workshop environment, but that doesn't mean they're, you know, I don't know. I don't know what it means.
So here's the song. I just decided to pull up my list. So here are the songs that I've downloaded so far. Always Here, Ramana's song, Handiwork of God, of course, Happy Birthday, Jesus, Why Sufis Whirl, Who You Really Are, Living Truth, Church of the Pines, I Said That I Would Sing, I Invite Love Here, Already Home, Already Free, and Flow of Grace.
Good.
So.
Yep. Maybe I would say that 8 or 9 of those are part of my like core set list when I do a concert. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything I'm missing that maybe I haven't discovered yet that you think that I really should add to my list?
You know, the one that I quoted from about viewing life from the balcony is the train song, and it's one that people can relate to, and I'm kind of fond of it for its simplicity of language and. In a way, it says everything that I've ever wanted to say, you know, in a teaching kind of way. So I would, yeah.
Okay, I've written that one down, and I will get that one immediately after we're done. Because as I mentioned, you know, I have a large variety of songs, and in fact, one of the things that I do, I love to hear different artists all the time. So I don't have a lot from one person, and you really are the only one that I have a lot from. And I think that is because I do perceive your songs as teaching songs or reminding songs. And I just think they're really gorgeous. I'm grateful that I've come across you. I wish I had the lyrics to all the songs, because I would love to ask you about some of the lyrics. And maybe, I mean, I've copied some of the lyrics down. I don't know if I can get to it quickly enough. There's one song that I'm remembering. I'm not remembering the words good enough, but maybe you'll know what I'm talking about. There's a song where it seems like you're kind of saying thank you to the others who have brought, it's kind of like, some of the verses are like, kind of like the whole Ho'oponopono thing. I love you. I'm sorry. Which song is that? Do you remember?
That's I Invite Love Here.
That's an I Invite Love Here. Yeah. Is there anything about that song that's bringing to your mind that you can talk about? It seems to me like there was a line in the song, something about thanking the others who bring to your attention what you need to see.
Yeah, I'd have to actually look that one up.
Yeah, that's what I have to do, too. I have to look at the lyrics. So you have the same kind of memory.
You know, it's a newer song that I wrote toward the end of my last recording, and I didn't really establish it as firmly in my consciousness as I usually do.
Do you keep the lyrics in front of you when you're singing?
No. I don't, actually. I actually try to remember them. I have to practice a lot to hold 15 or 16 songs in my consciousness as well, because I'm working on new ones. So, and that's not in my songbook, so I can't access that.
Okay, well, I think what I have done, Awakening Together has what we call Awakening Together Daily Quotes, where people contemplate a quote each day, and then we get together at 10 p.m. Eastern time at night, and we discuss them. And what I've done is I've copied down some of portions of your songs, and I've posted them as the Awakening Together Daily Quotes, and I'm sure that one is coming. But it doesn't look like it's been posted yet. You know, it'll come on another day. But let me just read some of the lyrics that I do have posted. This one's from July 4th. Is it in the sunlit meadow? Is it in the rocks and trees? Is it in the blue and yellow? Is it in the one who sees? This radiance I recognize even when I close my eyes. Is it in the circumstances? Is it in a quiet mind? Does it only come in glimpses? Is it an event in time? This peace that permeates my mind, my moods, these changing states? Is it in your form that I hold so dear, or older than your ocean eyes? When you walk away, does it disappear? Could it be so localized? This love, which no one claims, you come, you go, but it remains. I cannot see how I missed this before. The love we are is always here, of this I am sure. So as you can tell, I didn't write the whole song because I'm writing it as a quote for contemplation. But as I read that, is there anything that comes up that you want to share about that song or when you wrote it?
You know, I don't remember the context of writing it, but I do know that I love singing that song. And I love it because it, you know, it's, you know how sometimes I used to think only an answer to a question could quiet the mind, but sometimes a question can quiet the mind. And, you know, the usual kinds of questions people use in self-inquiry be like, who am I? To whom does a thought arise? But I decided to use other questions. Well, I guess that's the principle behind a Zen koan also. A question that will just like, the mind can't answer in a simple, definitive way. I mean, maybe it can, but maybe it can't. And then I throw one question out in the song, and then another, and then another, and another. Because the mind has a tendency to want to find where is this enlightenment, as we were talking about earlier in the interview. Is it a state that I can attain? And so it was my own way of playing. I wasn't even consciously doing this, it just came out that way, but it was my own way of playing with where is this peace? Where does this peace reside? Where is the love? Where is this awakening that I'm feeling? You know, is it in your words? Is it in between the words? Is it in the, you know, it's like, is it in my consciousness? Is it out in the outside world? Is it inside world? Is it? And peace, you know, people think peace is something that can be obtained in if they could only get their circumstances more ideal, you know. But is it? Is it in the circumstances? I mean, haven't we all experienced peace in the middle of difficult circumstances and sometimes had really easy circumstances and been in turmoil? You know, is it the love we feel for somebody else? Is it in their form? Is it in me? Is it in between us? You know, it's like a way to kind of loosen the hold the mind has on where it thinks things are and how they can be found and what they mean. It's just kind of a gentle musical way of hopefully stopping the mind so that it can open to what's always here, which is the name of the song, Always Here.
Yeah, thank you. It actually does that very well. It's a beautiful song, and the way you described just now, you know, how you were playing with it, and that's why you wrote it. That's mm-hmm. how I experience it when I listen to it. So, so the transmission happened. We do have a hand up. So what I'm going to do is let go of the mic, and Jacqueline, turn it over to you. Jacqueline, the mic is yours. It might just take her a moment to grab the mic. Some people are a little slow. Here she comes.
Do I have a mic?
Yeah, she's a little quiet.
Yeah?
She usually talks on a phone.
Thank you so much. My goodness. What a gorgeous hour. I do want to, and I'm thrilled that you'll be in Santa Barbara, because we'll all be there. I want to ask about a specific song that I heard once, and I keep looking and looking on YouTube, and I can't find it again. And I think it was about, this is what I think it said. So I was out in space, and I looked down, and it looked like it was just, or life, or life in the body was going to be a groovy thing, so I agreed to come, and ooh, it's kind of icky here. And there's this problem and that problem, and then there's this wonderful resolve at the end of that. So if you could say what song that is so I could find it, I would love it. Thank you.
So.
Okay, I have the mic again. You can go ahead and answer, Katana.
Yeah, I didn't hear the very last part of the question, but I think you mainly wanted to identify the song.
Yeah.
And it's I Said That I Would Sing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't put anything on YouTube, so it's only, the ones you hear on YouTube are only because people have, usually without asking me, decided to put one of my songs on YouTube, but you can find it on iTunes and other places like that. That was a song, it's funny, I started that song, I wrote the first verse of that song 20-something years ago, and I thought it was funny, you know, but I honestly couldn't finish it because I didn't know how the story ended until, you know, several years ago. So I didn't finish. I started it like 20 years ago, but didn't finish it, except maybe 3 years ago.
Hmm.
But that's kind of like a mini story of, it's a mini autobiography, really. And it describes the pathos and the angst I felt as a young girl, you know, sensing that something more was possible, a deeper level of being, but knowing that I had experienced it, but not knowing how to get back to it, and wondering, really, I mean, I really had this thought that maybe I got off at the wrong bus stop. And, you know, when I sing that song, I the first time I shared that publicly, I thought, I don't know, many people are going to be able to relate to this. They might laugh. But and I'm astounded at how many people can relate to that song.
Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely song. And, in fact, when you were talking about, you know, your experience earlier and how you felt as a young person, that was the song I was reminded of as you were speaking. So.
Yeah.
It was one of the first ones that I downloaded when I was first checking out who is this Kirtana person. So that one caught me very quickly.
Mm. Well, you know, you feel like, I mean, I felt like a stranger in a strange land, but it didn't occur to me that everybody else that was here acting as if they knew the language and the currency, was also feeling the same thing. So that was a good, that was good for me to see.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not one of the ones who didn't feel like I belonged. I did.
Oh, good.
But what happened for me was I got to this point in my life where I had done everything I set out to do, and I was basically happy. I mean, as far as happiness in the world goes, there was stress and sometimes anger, but, you know, compared to everybody else, I was doing okay. But then I kind of thought, now what? You know, it's like I got done way too early. There's still life to live here. And when I started asking, now what, that's when the spiritual seeking just kind of came up as the next thing to do. And then it led to places that I never imagined. So
Interesting.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Another one of your songs that recently we have contemplated. Here's some of the lyrics. Why do you seek the path that leads away deeper into the woods when home is your aim? Why do you pitch your tent on foreign land? Turn toward the south. Go back the way you came. Knowing the world of form to be a dream, fashioned from consciousness, a mind is quelled. Everything that is only self. How can you be attracted or repelled? I think I may have misquoted that a little bit. But how can you be attracted if everything that is, that's it,
yeah,
if everything that is only self? How can you be attracted or repelled? Give up for good tomorrow, which is false. Immerse yourself and dwell in the heart instead. In the presence of that holiness, this is my favorite line, do not even raise your head. Yeah. And that would be Ramana's song, correct?
Yeah, so I don't take credit for any of those words. I was reading that book, I can't remember the name of that particular book, something like Dhammapada or something. And it's all Ramana's words. And I'd read different books by Ramana before, and most of them seem kind of scholarly and academic, and I didn't have an opinion about that, except that when I started reading this one, it seemed so poetic. Some of the phrasing seemed so poetic, and I was actually reading it to take a break from some songwriting I was doing. I had my ukulele in hand earlier, and I was working on a song, and then I took a break and picked up that book, and I started reading it, and I went, wow, this is so poetic. The reference to the ruby of the mind and giving over the ruby of the mind. And I've only had this happen once before, where I took something like a scripture and put it to music, but I couldn't resist trying to put it to music because the poetry was so beautiful. And even though, you know, when you write a song, you're limited with meter and rhyme, I felt like I was able to get very close to the actual translation I was using. Like in the group of words you quoted, he didn't say tent, so that was the only, he said take up, right, why do you take up residence? So I did pitch your tent for the meter and for the meaning, but I stayed very true to his meaning, and do not even raise your head was an exact translation. So I just thought it was so beautiful about the temple of the heart.
Well, that's why then, that's why it sounded so much like him to me.
Yeah,
because that's what I thought. I thought this, you know, you really captured him in this song. This is him. I feel like he is speaking to me through this song.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, because that was what the intention, to just be as true as I could and still put it to music.
Yeah, you did a great job. Let's see, here's another one that we have contemplated already. We contemplated this one on July 14th. This is from Why Do Sufis Whirl, I believe. I never understood the Last Supper. I did not know what to think when Jesus said, my body is this bread and my blood this drink. Had he merged with all of creation or found some fountain of youth? Now I see what I thought was alchemy is just the literal truth. And you don't need to be a Christian mystic or be born under a lucky star. You only need to be still and ask who you are. be still and know who you are. To know the sound of one hand clapping, you don't have to read Lao Tzu, just look around. This is the sound. Do you hear it too? One hand clapping, one heart singing, one being, being me and you. Only one unmoving ocean where many waves pass through. And you don't need to be a Zen Buddhist to pierce the heart of this mystery. You only need to be willing to stop and see. See what is still and free. And you don't need to be a whirling dervish or study scripture or travel far. You only need to be still and ask who you are. Be willing to know who you are. Nothing to say about that, huh? Well, I'll tell you a secret. It's not really a secret, it's just that nobody knows. If it was a secret, I'd have to keep my mouth shut. But I never understood the one hand clapping until I heard that song. And then I realized, I was like, of course.
I never understood the one hand clapping thing until the word came out of my mouth. Seriously. I'm like, it wasn't like I went, oh, I get that. I understand that code finally. I think I'll write about that.
Yeah.
I was just singing the song and it came out of my mouth and I'm like, yeah, this is the sound. This is the sound.
So we both got it from the song.
You know, and when I sing it, I can really put the emphasis on it. You know, this is the sound. And I can look at everybody and go, this is the sound.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
In a way that maybe it's stronger.
Yeah.
Looking at the lyrics.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate that because it just came to me so clearly, you know. And, of course, as you know, you can't then describe that sound for anyone else. But it came to me so clearly through that song, so I love that very, very much. Let's see, we have only about 13 minutes left, so what I want to do is just invite everyone in the room. Everyone is listening. People are actually downloading songs as we're speaking.
You can tell that? You're tracking them all?
No, they're telling me. They're typing in there. Because, see, they can type in the room and make comments.
Yeah.
So I can read what they're writing. So that's going on. But I want to invite everyone, just remind you that we have 13 minutes left. And if anybody has a question, anything that you'd like to hear Kirtana speak about, you know, now is the time to put your hand up. And I will allow you to share. Let me be still for a moment and see if I have any other questions myself. I feel almost complete, which is good since we're getting close to the end of the time. How about you? Oh, we do have a hand. So sure enough, somebody else is going to take the conversation now. So Lynn, I am releasing the mic to you. She hasn't taken the mic yet. Here she comes, I think. Let's see. Lynn, just to let you know, I do not see a mic yet, so please try again.
Okay, do you see a mic now?
Yes.
My mic is acting really weird. Anyway, I practice bhakti yoga, and I chant. And I'm just wondering if chanting has been a part of your practice. And because your name is Kirtana, and because I do kirtan, I just wondered if that was related.
All right, let me get the mic back. All right, Kirtana, go ahead and answer.
Yeah, that's a good question. I have chanted before. But not really as a practice. I mean, I've enjoyed chanting before in various circumstances. I like the way I feel when I chant, but I haven't done that as a practice. And my name, you know, it's hard to explain my name. Like if I were starting over again now with the explosion of kirtan practice, I mean, I took the name, 24 years ago and there were people doing kirtan and bhajans, but I hadn't heard the word kirtana used in reference to kirtan. And somebody tuned into that as a possible name for me, and I love the sound of it. And I have a close friend who studies Sanskrit, and she had a big fat Sanskrit dictionary, and I looked up the meaning after feeling the resonance, and I already knew what, you know, kirtan meant in terms of devotional singing, but I looked up the actual root in Sanskrit of kirtan, and it means that which is worthy of uttering.
Ah.
And I thought, that's a good energy to align with. Now, for most people, you know, most Hindis, the only thing worth uttering is the name of God. But for me, other things are worth uttering. Maybe at some point, nothing is worth uttering, I don't know. Maybe only silence. But so far, some other things are worth uttering. So that's what I'm doing. But I know I occasionally have somebody come to one of my concerts going, or come up to me after a concert and go, oh, I thought you were going to do kirtan. I came up to sing, but really glad I came still. Yeah, I say, yeah, I hope you weren't too disappointed. But I took the name a long time ago, and it still feels right to me, but it could be confusing to people.
Yeah, I, you know, again, I'm fairly ignorant about a lot of things, and so I heard the name Kirtana, you know, as I discovered you, and I had no idea about Kirtan, and I went to a retreat in Costa Rica in March, and one of the things we were invited to while we were there was a kirtan. I went, oh, so maybe this is why she's called kirtana. But it was the first time I'd heard the word. So I
just say,
yeah, I knew your name first. Yeah, my spiritual path has been very, very inward.
Mm-hmm.
Only in the last year, because of Awakening Together, only in the last year have I started looking more outward and getting to know who else is out there and teaching and sharing. So I'm just getting to know everyone, and I'm having a blast. But really still quite ignorant about who all is out there. So
it doesn't really matter. It's just that kirtan has become popular enough that it could be more confusing than I would have anticipated 24 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's see if, again, we only have a few minutes left. Does anyone else have a question? My dog is asking me to finish.
Your dog has a question.
When will you be done? Yeah. Yeah. She gets tired of me sitting here doing what I do here sometimes. So, gosh, maybe if nothing else comes up, maybe we'll just go ahead and end a little early rather than you know, sit here and stare at each other. I am excited about seeing you in Santa Barbara, getting to know you. I'm very excited about the concert. For those who don't know, we're going to be doing a couple of different things with Kirtana. One is her music will be sprinkled throughout the entire weekend. So like when we open the session, there may be a song. When we end the session, there may be a song. You know, because it's great to mix music with talking. The music is wonderful. But also on Saturday night in the chapel, we are going to have a concert. So for that period of time, that will be all her, whatever she wants to say or whatever, I should say whatever saying comes through her.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. And also, you know, the whatever music she plays. I think we have a little bit of challenges with sound system, but I'm going to work with her and see if we can get that worked out. But the last time we were there, we had a musician by the name of Larry Sire. He plays guitar. He doesn't sing. And I checked pictures. He didn't have a mic at all. And we had 40 people in the room and could hear that very, very well. And it was just an acoustic guitar. So I think that the director who told us the acoustics there are very good. Was correct. But you and I will still work together and figure out what we need and get it there, because I want everyone to enjoy the concert.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And meeting some of this awakening community.
Yeah, and also, I don't know if you've ever been to the Old Mission in Santa Barbara, but it is a gorgeous place. It's an actual Franciscan monastery. Is that how you say it when they're from the St. Francis lineage?
I think so.
Yeah, it's an actual Franciscan monastery now, so you'll see the monks walking around.
Great.
We'll have to end the concert by 10 because 10 p.m. is quiet time at the monastery. And they have lots of beautiful flowers and lots of wonderful places if you want to sneak out a little bit and just sit and be alone. It's just, it's a wonderful place just to be. So, in fact, it was the location itself that inspired the retreat.
Beautiful. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it should
be wonderful. And being there.
Yeah, it should be wonderful. So, all right, well, then I think what I will do is just go ahead and say our goodbyes for now. I will email you tomorrow.
Okay.
So I'll be in touch extremely soon. But it's been really wonderful spending this time with you tonight and letting you share your story with us. And I'm very happy. I look forward to seeing you again in September.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm really looking forward to it, too.
All right. Good night.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Have a good evening.
You too.
All right. So that's it. I want to thank you all for coming. I hope you all enjoyed that as much as I did. And now, you know, now I'm even more excited for September now that I've gotten to know her. I'm more excited for September. It's really going to be a wonderful time. You know, getting together with her and Timothy and Magdy and all of you in that, as I mentioned, in that beautiful, beautiful place, the old mission. So what I'm going to do is turn the mic over to Lynn, and I'm going to go and save these recordings and hopefully get them posted. But I will be back in 34 minutes so that we can discuss the Magdy quote from today. So, Lynn, the mic is yours.